This podcast discusses domestic violence, criminal behavior, murder, and adult themes. While not explicit, listener discretion is advised. A crowd milled around tables in the banquet hall of a downtown Salt Lake City hotel. They munched on food and chatted about the latest workplace gossip. Susan loved it. She rarely had the opportunity anymore to rub shoulders with people outside of work and church. This fancy Christmas party with her coworkers felt like a big event. It was December of 2008, 1 year before her disappearance. Most people there were dressed up. Susan had shown up in jeans. It was her day off. Still, she was having a good time. Josh seemed to be as well, to her surprise. He was engrossed in a conversation about programming, HTML, .NET, all that nerd stuff that went over Susan's head. Her interest in computers only reached as far as her MySpace page or maybe Facebook. Josh, though, lived with his nose buried in a laptop. He didn't read much, except for technical manuals and how-to books about programming. He was pestering the Wells Fargo Investments IT guy at the table, bragging about his websites. Amber Hardman, one of Susan's best work friends, sat with her husband Scott at the same end of the table.
Prior companies that we had worked for didn't have work parties where our spouses were invited, so it was nice to be able to bring our spouses and hang out and get to know each other.
The conversation turned to television. Josh and Susan had recently binged seasons of the show 24. They also loved crime dramas like CSI.
They were obsessed with this one show and they'd actually watch it together. That was one thing I remember. Susan would talk about how her and Josh would actually watch that together. And they liked that show. So, something they had in common.
True crime stories fascinated Josh. He liked to dissect the missteps made by killers.
Yeah, they were talking about it, and I remember hearing him say, those shows are so dumb, those people always put the bodies in the stupidest places, it's always so obvious. And that's kind of where it turned to the conversation about the mines in the Western Desert. Josh's like, if it was me, have you ever been out to the West Desert? There's mines everywhere. Nobody's gonna find anything out there. And I thought that was crazy. Only because who would think of that? Like, who actually sits there and thinks about where they're gonna hide a body that'd be better than these TV shows? You know, they've got it all wrong, but you know, Josh.
This is Cold, Episode 7, Scouring the Desert. I'm Dave Cawley. Right back after this.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
You can power up your playtime with the Nintendo Switch system, the home of Mario and friends. You may discover exciting surprises with Mario, Princess Peach, and more in Super Mario Bros. Wonder, or challenge friends to a race in Mario Kart 8 Deluxe. You can head to Nintendo.com to learn more about the Nintendo Switch system. Games and systems sold separately.
So, Josh had put some serious thought into the value of hiding a body in an abandoned mine. During the Christmas party, he explained, old mine shafts are unstable, and it would be difficult or impossible for anyone to find or retrieve a body from one.
So that was a year before Susan disappeared. I just thought it was an odd conversation to even have. Like, where would you hide a body? And I think that's why it kind of stuck with me. Because even then, I knew Susan and Josh had problems. And even then, she had already brought things up like, sometimes he scares me. I don't always feel safe, you know.
It didn't seem Josh understood just how his flippant talk about dead bodies affected other people. In fact, Susan had called attention to his tone-deaf conversation style in a letter just weeks before.
You seem physically incapable of having a conversation that doesn't revolve around your interests. Whether it be politics, the economy, energy crisis, conserving, etc. It's like you have no ability to notice if your audience doesn't want to talk about your topic. Or if, heaven forbid, they disagree with you.
Josh's habit of dominating conversations was a recurring theme in my interviews with people who knew him, like neighbor Dax Guzman.
And he talked a lot. He talked a lot. A guy could talk a lot.
Or Kiersey Hellowell.
He was so talkative all the time, like over the top. Like if you had a conversation with him, it would go on for 6 hours with him doing all the talking and you doing none. Because he just liked to talk and he was loud. He talked at the top of his lungs all the time. Always wanted to push his opinion and his views, and he didn't like anyone to disagree with him.
Susan could see her marriage was not like her friends' marriages. She tried to talk Amber into arranging a sort of double date with their husbands, hoping Scott Hardman's example might rub off on Josh.
She kind of looked up to our marriage and idolized our Scott and I's marriage and friendship that we have and our closeness.
But after all the talk of bodies and minds, Scott wanted nothing to do with Josh. Amber tried and tried to talk Susan into leaving Josh, but Susan wouldn't do it.
I mean, she had at one point, and I don't remember when it was between then and when she went missing, had said, if I go missing or something happens to me, if I end up dead, no, I didn't commit suicide. No, it wasn't me. I would never do that. I mean, she told me that outright and clearly. So, I mean, that's frustrating in itself.
About 3 months after that Christmas party, in March of 2009, Josh decided to take Charlie and Braden out for a camping trip in Utah's West Desert. Susan wasn't invited. Temperatures that night dropped below freezing. Josh and the boys weren't equipped for the cold. Susan wrote this about it in an email.
Josh took the kids to the desert starting Saturday 5 p.m. to go camping and showed up at 2 a.m. because the kids wouldn't settle down and he was worried about them being cold. All Sunday, they had fevers.
Susan had not wanted Josh to go, especially with the boys. She was consumed with concern the whole time they were away.
I was at a Mary Kay dinner thing until 10 p.m. Saturday night, trying not to worry about the kids, and hoping I could politely say, I told you so.
6 weeks later, Susan noted in another email that her tight-fisted husband had developed a sudden new interest in the desert.
He just bought a $65 car rack, I assume for all the camping we don't do, and tells me we need to stop spending money.
I asked Susan's friend Amber if perhaps Josh was doing reconnaissance, studying the landscape, looking for mines, a full 10 months before Susan's disappearance.
You kind of wonder, because he did have a fascination with going out to the West Desert camping all of a sudden. And prior to that, they were going other areas, and that was kind of a newer thing.
Josh decided to try camping again in May when temperatures were a bit warmer. Unlike in March, he asked Susan to come along as well. In an email, she asked him, "Do we even have a tent?" She knew the answer was no. The prior summer, she'd emailed an old friend saying she and Josh never really went on vacation. In fact, she'd never even visited any of Utah's 5 national parks, even after living in the state for 5 years.
I've never been to Vegas, and Josh and I have some lame gift certificate to stay in a hotel. If gas prices ever got under control, we could visit. Or those arch rock things in southern Utah that I've never been to.
Susan's friends suggested places she, Josh, and the boys could go, including several Forest Service campgrounds in the mountains near Salt Lake City. Most charged a small fee, and Susan knew Josh would never agree to pay it. He had different plans anyway. He didn't want to go to the mountains. He'd learned about a place where he could play geologist with the boys in the desert. They were going to hunt geodes. Geodes are hollow rocks that, when you crack them open, contain mineral deposits. In Susan's words, they were crystal sparkly things. Utah's hottest spot for finding geodes is a place called the Dugway Geode Beds. Amateur rock hounds can dig there for free, keeping what they find. Josh told Susan that's where they were going. They headed out on Saturday, May 30th of 2009. Susan described the drive in a journal entry.
At some point, you turn right, and the road turns into dirt. Keep driving, go over some type of mountain, pass a lot of Pony Trail Express monuments. Keep driving, if you're lucky, and don't mind the bumps and traveling about 50 miles per hour max on dirt roads. About 2 or 3 more hours at this point, and my cell phone was in a no-service range, but had changed the time zone to an hour earlier.
As you can tell, Susan was more or less lost. But I've spent some time in the West Desert myself and can interpret based on her descriptions and the photos she later posted to Facebook. Josh drove the Pony Express Trail over Lookout Pass and past Simpson Springs. From there, it's a pretty straight shot to the geode beds. But he didn't go to the geode beds. Instead, he turned off the Pony Express Road.
We found this little turnoff that I really wished we had an SUV for. Josh claims it's all about the driver, not the vehicle. Where we were literally on a dirt path of maybe 2 tire tracks if we were lucky, and all these huge rocks. Eventually, I told Josh that we weren't going to make our van drive anymore. It wasn't safe.
Josh pressed on, driving south along the flank of the Thomas Range to the vicinity of Topaz Mountain.
We found this white quarry, and I found out later that it had real topaz in it.
It's not clear to me if Josh knew where he was going all along, or if he stumbled upon Topaz Mountain by accident. Like the geode beds, it's a spot where people can collect crystals. He gave his boys hammers, safety glasses, and earplugs. Then they went looking for sparkly rocks. I need to make a quick correction here. Since the release of this episode, I've learned the white quarry Susan described was actually on the northern end of the Thomas Range, not the southern end. It was an old mining claim called Solar Wind, just west of Dugway Pass and a short distance south of the Pony Express Trail. Thank you to Dave Stemmons for the tip, which I independently verified.
There is a small hill of sand with huge black beetles in it that the boys got so excited over. Since we were in the wrong place, we were very successful in finding other creatures.
Susan screamed at the sight and sound of a coiled rattlesnake. She clutched both of her boys. Josh, on the other hand, was fascinated. He talked to his boys excitedly about reptiles while flinging rocks at the snake. Daylight was fading, so the family returned to their minivan.
We drove and found one lone light that was a place called Fish Springs National Wildlife Refuge Headquarters. We read about their visitor signs, and by this time it was pitch dark. So we decided to come back in the morning and drove about half hour away and parked in a kind of deserted gravel quarry just to the side of the road.
They slept crammed into the back of the minivan. In the morning, Josh cooked a breakfast of pancakes, sausage, and eggs.
It was nice to have Josh cook breakfast. Just unfortunate that I have to be camping in order to experience it.
They spent much of that day exploring Fish Springs before finally finding the geode beds. By then, the boys were getting fussy and dark clouds were gathering on the horizon. Susan said it was time to go home. The rocky desert roads had taken their toll, though. One of the rear tires on the minivan went flat. Then it started to rain. A passerby stopped and helped Josh mount the spare tire.
We then had to basically limp home, no faster than 35 miles per hour, on dirt roads with potholes the entire time. With me worrying that if the spare can't take it, we were out of service on our cell phones, and there were not any more cars passing us by.
Susan attributed her family's safe return to divine intervention. She called their camping trip freeing for Josh. She was putting Charlie and Braden down to bed a few weeks later when she overheard Josh in the other room, talking to his dad on the phone.
I heard him say, "No, Susan didn't go camping with us that time." I heard him laugh, I assume at his dad joking that I wouldn't enjoy it, or prefer church instead, or I'm the party pooper or something. Then he said, "Yeah, I just found some people and bummed off their campfire so I didn't have to build my own."
She told a friend in that email what she heard sounded suspicious. Even more suspicious were the words spoken by Charlie the day after he returned home from the December camping trip with his dad. I've touched on this in a previous episode, but it deserves a closer look. On Tuesday, December 8th, Charlie told Detective Kim Welty that his mom had gone camping with him but stayed behind at Dinosaur National Park. Welty asked him where at the park, and Charlie said, "Where the crystals are." He explained crystals are colorful and grow inside of rocks. Sounds like he was describing geodes, right? It's a tricky thing, though, interviewing a four-year-old.
So challenging. I mean, I work child sex offenses, child abuse cases, and those are challenging when they're that young.
Detective Ellis Maxwell told me kids can be unreliable. They're too distractible or too scared or too easily led to deliver the answer an interviewer wants to hear. Detective Welty had special training for these kinds of interviews and knew to use a light touch. Now, the West Valley City Police Department released a transcript of this interview in 2013. They did not include the audio recording. I tried to get it using an open records request, which West Valley City denied. It turns out recordings made at Children's Justice Center locations in Utah are exempted from the state's open records law. That makes sense in most cases. Public release could cause additional harm to kids who witness or are victims of horrible crimes. I get that. There are special privacy concerns to consider, too. I get that as well. But there's a reason why I believed, and I still believe, this audio is important. In this case, there's no privacy left to protect. Charlie is gone. Transcript is valuable, but it can't convey all of the nuance of speech, especially from a young child. How Charlie responded to questions might reveal as much about his thinking as the actual words he used. I appealed West Valley's denial of my request. It was denied again. I then had some very smart lawyers look at the law, and they told me in so many words that I couldn't win. So I dropped the appeal. Unfortunately, that means I can't play you the audio of what happened. I'll describe it instead, going off the transcript. Detective Welty asked Charlie what his mommy had said. Charlie replied, "Mommy said she wanted to stay, so she slept where the flowers and crystals grow." Welty asked if Charlie saw that place. He said, "Yeah," and said there were a whole bunch of red berries. Then he changed his mind and said the berries were blue. Welty asked if his mommy had been happy or sad. Charlie said happy. She wanted to stay because the crystals were so pretty. He said he stayed where there were no crystals, but where there were lizards, pythons that weren't in the wild, and snakes that live in Dinosaur National Park. Charlie's repeated references to a dinosaur national park seemed perplexing. There is no Dinosaur National Park in the United States. But there is a Dinosaur National Monument. It sits on the Utah-Colorado border, about a three-hour drive east of Salt Lake City. The monument protects the spot where, in 1909, a paleontologist discovered the skeletal fossils of a large sauropod called Apatosaurus. Josh, Susan, and the boys had visited Dinosaur that August for the 100-year anniversary of the discovery. They'd camped near the Green River.
My coworker's saying be very careful with the water in that area. I don't know that we'd want to go swimming and deal with all that. Maybe just wading up to our knees or something while in shorts. Of course, we will have the children glued to us.
They again slept in the minivan on this trip, just as they had on the Pony Express Trail in May. Around that same time, Josh pushed to get the boys into another dinosaur-themed attraction a bit closer to home. Thanksgiving Point, a destination with flower gardens, museums, and restaurants, was running a $2 Tuesday promotion. That meant Josh could take Charlie and Braden to Thanksgiving Point's Museum of Ancient Life for a fraction of the normal cost. Memories of these two dinosaur-themed outings were likely blurred in Charlie's mind, muddled up with recollections of the topaz, geodes, and rattlesnake from the Pony Express trip.
You know, you can't put a lot of credit in the children's sense of time at that age.
Ellis and the rest of West Valley City's major crimes team weren't able to make much sense out of what Charlie had told them. Talk of crystals and berries and Dinosaur National Park were just too vague. A cold January wind whipped across the landscape as the four-wheelers rolled over dirt, mud, and snow. Louis Amott and Tony Gallegos were riding with West Valley City Police into the heart of the Great Basin, into the rugged recesses of remote mountain ranges, into the West Desert. They were looking for mines. They were looking for Susan's body.
We were, you know, sort of experts in this field. We knew what to do around mines, or Louis' familiarity with some of the areas. So, gee, we'll help you find these mines, and we'll help you safely evaluate them. But then the goal of finding a body or clues, that was a little somber.
To look at the area on a typical street map, you'd just see a big, blank, white spot. But Amott and Gallegos knew the region better than most. At the time, they worked for the Utah Department of Natural Resources. They were the experts when it came to abandoned mines. That's why police had asked for their help.
The area that they had was basically the West Desert of Utah, which could contain 5,000-10,000 abandoned shafts. A few of those would be applicable to leaving someone there.
West Valley detectives made their first scan of some abandoned mines on December 16th and 17th, just a week and a half after Susan's disappearance. It was like dipping a toe into the ocean. The task of searching all of those holes in the ground was gargantuan, a fact they were just beginning to grasp. Detectives David Greco and Max Cook had drawn the assignment. Just after Christmas of 2009, they met with Louis and Tony to see what they were up against.
I was surprised that they contacted us and said, hey, we're looking at these mine openings. Do you guys have some information?
Mm-hmm.
They were kind of open to that, and we said, well, as a matter of fact, we do. Yeah. And, you know, then once they saw how the scope of it, they had to step back and narrow their parameters a little bit, said, okay, what do you know about these areas? And what maps and so on?
It was a bit of science and a bit of psychology. Police knew Josh's minivan wasn't capable of reaching mines high on canyon walls or at the end of rough, rocky trails, especially considering they'd been blanketed with snow on the day of Susan's disappearance. They also knew Josh was a bit lazy and lacked the physical strength to carry or drag Susan very far.
I remember that we had this search parameter of the Pony Express Road and kind of the loop around the back of the mountains and then south coming through the Tenix. So based on that road and access or time from that, they kind of came up with this zone, and it went probably from West Valley down to Eureka and then mm-hmm. to the west a little bit.
From the Simpson Springs, where they knew that he was, they kind of put like a 3-hour driving time. And so the radius from there was sort of what we looked at. So the Tenix, the Ochre Mountains here,
of course, yeah.
Clear out to the perimeter, the edge of it would have been the Gold Hill area mm-hmm. out in the Deep Creek Mountains would be the farthest, probably the farthest west. But then I know it also extended down towards Ely.
That's Lewis. He retired a few years ago, wrapping up a career that spanned more than 30 years. At the time police approached him in 2009, he was deeply involved with Utah's abandoned mine reclamation program.
That was, for me personally, a very, very hard time because we wanted to help to get resolution to what was going on. But then I didn't really want to be there. I didn't want to find anything where you wanted to find something, but you didn't want to find it. So it was not, for me personally, a fun time, but it was something that I felt I needed to do and wanted to help.
They got a hold of a borehole camera.
We're almost on the bottom.
It's kind of like the cameras plumbers sometimes use to look for clogs in pipes.
Plenty of light. Yeah.
Except on steroids.
It has its own cable and lighting and camera system, and it can record sound as well. I think it has like a 1,000-foot range on it. It's electric, so it's all portable. So Lewis and I had used it before, and then the detectives requested that we bring it so that we could look at some of these shafts.
That's Tony, formerly an engineer with the state. Neither Lewis nor Tony has ever spoken publicly about their involvement with the effort to search for Susan in the mines of the West Desert.
It was never out in the public that everywhere that we looked and how soon after she disappeared that we spent time looking.
Police swore them to secrecy. They signed legally binding non-disclosure agreements.
This was while Josh was still alive, so we really couldn't say anything or say, oh yeah, we're out looking here and we're looking there, because they didn't want to alert him of what was going on either.
Because of the disclosure agreement, it's sort of like at the end of the day, Lewis and I could talk to each other about certain things, but yeah, you really couldn't discuss it with your coworkers or your spouse or anything. So, and most of them were cooperative. Yeah, so you guys were out in the field last week? Yeah. They're like, okay,
yeah, they understand.
How was the weather? How, you know, this sort of thing. We didn't talk about the areas. We didn't talk about any of that.
Their secret search kicked off on January 4th of 2010. They spent 2 weeks living out of borrowed barrack space at the U.S. Army's Dugway Proving Ground, right on the edge of the search zone.
The day would start at 5:30 in the morning, and you get up and you think, yeah, this could be an exciting day, but you'd work into the evening, sometimes 10:30 at night, trying to plot out things to see where you're going to go next. So it was very long days and a very difficult time. We expected snow and that our days would start well before daylight and end well after dark. We would still be out on the ground looking until the very last light and then find your way back in the dark.
At least one instance, we started out with some ATVs because we thought, based on the snow conditions and the road access, we thought, well, this will work. And didn't quite work. I think we ended up getting stuck. We had to dig out a couple of vehicles, shovel, and a couple of the ATVs. And then you needed extra winter gear, gaiters. And then sometime later than that, we switched to snow machines, snowmobiles, just to get to some of those areas.
At each mine, they broke out high-intensity spotlights. Twice each day, the detectives called home using a satellite phone to report their progress. The work came with a whole host of hazards.
You have an opening there that it's not like a cave. A cave is stable, where these mine openings are totally unstable. The collar, the area right around the opening to the mine is very unstable. Rocks fall down. And then also there are animals in there. I've had rattlesnakes and cougars and things like that inside. But then also a bigger concern is that we always carried an air monitor to monitor oxygen levels, because you get back into these workings and there's no air circulation and there's a lot of times a lack of oxygen. So you could, you know, pass out, wake up dead.
Tony told me these mines are no place for the public.
They're workings that were man-made and they haven't been maintained for years. So the rock is going to crumble or fall from the roof. The timbers are going to rot. They may fill up with water. When you're walking in there, you may have a flashlight, but you really can't see, and you won't have an instrument that tells you there's oxygen or not. And then there may also be explosives in some of these.
Yes.
Things like old, sweaty dynamite or blasting caps that you wouldn't even see or be aware of until it was too late.
The mines they searched ranged from shallow holes in the ground to complex networks of adits and shafts. An adit is a horizontal passage. A shaft is vertical.
Typically, in some of these old workings, you go in 20, 30 feet, and there would be what's called a raise, which is a shaft that goes down, and it would be right in the middle of where you're walking. And if there's water, sometimes there's a veneer of dust on the water, and so it looks like it's solid ground, and you step into it, and it's 45-degree water that you're stepping into that's in a filled shaft. And if you're alone, everything is wet and slippery. You'd have a really hard time getting out by yourself. But the main concern would be a lack of oxygen in these mines and things falling. And timbers in these old mines are very rotten.
Under a federal law passed in 1977, the government can take over, clean up, and close abandoned mines. Sometimes they collapse the mine openings on purpose or plug them with rocks and dirt. Other times, they put together steel grates to cover the openings so bats can still come and go. Lewis, Tony, and the detectives inspected the locks and metal grates, looking for signs of tampering. Police knew the acetylene torch Josh had bought just a couple of weeks before Susan's disappearance could have cut through rebar. At mine shafts too deep to inspect from the surface, the team broke out the borehole camera.
It is Wednesday, the 6th of January, 2010. It is 11:16 a.m.
We'd anchor it off and then start filming.
All right, Lewis, we're good to go.
Okay.
So what we need to do is hold and move the pulley across on the rebar.
Okay, so we need to come out.
Yeah, Max or someone else need a hand here.
The detectives would watch as we were going down.
Can you see it on your display on the recorder?
Yes.
If we did see something, we were supposed to stop, and we could pan the camera around. It had its own lighting system.
Your camera light on?
It was submersible, and the camera could angle up and down to a certain degree and then rotate.
There you go. Yeah, rotate and then pan up and down on the other side.
So we'd drop down so many feet and then move the camera around and pan around and then drop down further.
150 actual depth.
I think we're at. Yeah, we're at the bottom. We know we're at the bottom. Or we can, we're panning around, looking up and down, different angles.
Let me back up.
Is there a side shaft or was this just straight down one?
I didn't see anything off to the side, but then.
It's without the camera turned to the side, you can miss it.
Our instructions were if we actually saw anything, we were just going to hold off there and then let the detectives comment on the recording if they wanted to.
Doesn't look like there's a big, large object that's had dirt kicked over it either.
Mm-hmm. No.
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 This one's clear.
I think we're
at. You actually see the bottom? So what was down there?
Looks like there's some branches and things on the bottom. Looks like a white rock or something.
Okay, hang on a minute. Let me turn this light on and it may make it better or worse.
Okay. With the detectives that we were working with, to them, well, and to us also, it was very personal what was going on. And they felt, you know, we all had a stake in it. And so there was a camaraderie.
In those first weeks, they cleared mines in the Ochre, Tintic, Dugway, Fish Springs, Lakeside, and Deep Creek mountain ranges. And don't worry if none of that makes much sense. You can find an interactive map of the precise locations at thecoldpodcast.com. A word of warning, though. These mines are very dangerous. By February and March, the mine search expanded to the Simpson Mountains, the Thomas Range, and Topaz Mountain. As the detectives became more comfortable and gained better knowledge of the land and risks, Lewis and Tony stepped back.
As much work as we did, and the mine openings and the places we dropped the cameras, we did the best we could, but even still some of those places, there could have been something in there that we wouldn't have seen or discovered because it was remote or in the bottom of a shaft, and you still wonder what happened. Where is Susan Powell?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
If you're like me and refuse to let go of your skinny jeans, you're a millennial. And if you're a millennial, it's time to add Clarins Multi-Active Cream to your daily routine. Rooted in nature and innovated with science, Clarins has a long legacy of creating industry-first, plant-forward products. Using a skin charger complex made of 2% niacinamide and sea holly bioextract, Clarins Multi-Active Cream has been clinically proven to target the first visible signs of aging by smoothing lines and wrinkles, refining pores, evening tone and texture, and strengthening the skin's moisture barrier. While Multi-Active Cream can't bring back the golden age of boy bands, it can de-stress your skin. Clarins Multi-Active Cream is available online now. Go to clarins.com/truecrime and get Multi-Active Day and Night Cream for 10% off, a free welcome gift, plus free shipping on your first order. That's clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME.
With everyone fighting for attention, how can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media posting, and even events management. Don't know much about marketing? No sweat. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Tackle any challenge with Constant Contact's expert live customer support. Plus, everything's backed by their 30-day money-back guarantee. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
The detectives spent August and September of 2010 hunting down mines in the Silver City Zone south of Eureka, Utah. That fall, while working on another project in the same area, Lewis stumbled across a .357 Magnum handgun. He turned it over to the police, who determined it probably belonged to a hunter and was not connected to the case. By the one-year anniversary of Susan's disappearance, police had identified and visited hundreds of mines. They'd searched a wastewater treatment plant on the outskirts of West Wendover, Nevada. They'd followed up on a number of tips in the West Desert, even unearthing what turned out to be the remains of somebody's family pet. The small dog had been wrapped in a blanket and buried in a shallow grave. It's important to remember, this daunting task of cataloging and searching mines happened out of public view. The police didn't talk about it. They didn't go out in marked vehicles or wearing uniforms. They didn't want Josh to know where they were looking. In the eyes of the public, though, it seemed the police were ignoring a huge lead.
Most of us have been really glued to the whole thing since we were drowning. From the first news I heard about, they were missing. You know, I still remember that.
That's Paulette Bennett. More from her in a moment. In March of 2010, a company called Strategic Tactical Group started making plans for a public search of the area around Simpson Springs. They recruited other organizations like the Bridgerland Fire Company and proposed blanketing the area with thousands of volunteers. West Valley Police wanted nothing to do with it, especially since they had already scoured the area themselves. Besides, there were safety and liability concerns. In the end, the organizers invited only people with prior wilderness search and rescue experience. They told their teams to stay out of and away from mines. Search dogs walked grids, using their sensitive noses to sniff for any whiff of cadaver.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of study on the scent, and you see movies where they stick a bloodhound on a leash and they, off they go, and here we are. You know, it's like, not usually that cut and dried. Maybe if you're chasing a runaway prisoner or something, you know, yeah, they can follow the scent pretty good that way.
Paulette Bennett was with a nonprofit group called American Search Dogs. She brought her golden doodle, Murphy. Unfortunately, she didn't have any way to introduce Murphy to Susan's scent.
And so had we had a scent article of Susan's, they would have looked only for Susan. Because we didn't have that, we had to rely on the cadaver command. So they would be looking for human remains of some sort. And that can be, you know, that doesn't have to be a body. It could be fluids. It could be a lot of different things. Mm.
Paulette kept Murphy pointed into the wind as they worked their way through the low, brushy vegetation. They came across a surprising amount of garbage, a torn and weathered tent, a discarded sock, but none of it caught Murphy's nose.
They did find, we always found underwear when we were doing searches. It's amazing the people that dump underwear in the wilderness. But, you know, you find those things and different things that the dogs would look at. The only thing we found was there was, and my dog did not alert on it, was a piece of a spine. And I did call their attention to it just because I didn't.
The bones appeared to have come from a deer, or maybe an antelope. Many of Susan's friends were there for this search. Josh's estranged sister, Jennifer Graves, even made the drive out to Simpson Springs.
Because everyone was totally intent on wanting to know what happened. Yeah, and finding her, you know, at that point, everybody was, it was still new enough that you still felt like they might be able to find her and pin Josh. I mean, everybody, mm-hmm. quite frankly, knew. You can tell from my notes, I'm pretty biased, but I don't need to be unbiased. I'm not in the jury. Everyone felt like he was.
The volunteer search didn't uncover any evidence, but it did draw a lot of attention. Reporters and TV news cameras were there. Tony Gallegos, the abandoned mine expert, saw those stories.
You wanted to say, well, you don't need to look there anymore. Look somewhere else where we weren't able to spend time. But then again, you really even didn't want to encourage people to go into these mine openings that were really not safe. And you didn't want someone being hurt while they're out searching for someone. And, you know, it could be families or kids or whatever. So it was good that they were wanting to help, but it really didn't want to encourage people to go poking around the mine openings.
It is very dangerous.
Not a safe thing.
Josh and his family were also watching. A week later, Steve Powell wrote this in his journal.
I heard on the grapevine that cadaver dogs were employed and some things were found, according to TV news, not directly related to Susan Powell. We all wondered what indirect relationship the finds had to her, since the comment implied that.
Steve and his sons mocked the effort.
Michael has joked that Josh should make a comment like Br'er Rabbit, such as, search anywhere in West Valley, in Simpson Springs, in Salt Lake City, but please, please, don't search near Rattlesnake Rock. That's a sample of the morbid humor we indulge in from time to time. My contribution to the dark humor is, it's a good thing the Mormon Church did away with polygamy, because otherwise Josh would have had to dig more holes in the frozen hard desert ground.
Rattlesnake Rock? Where could he possibly have meant by that? Maybe it was the spot near Topaz Mountain, where Susan had shrieked after hearing a rattlesnake in May. Or maybe it was someplace far away, in Oregon or Washington. We may never know. Murphy, Paulette's big golden doodle, wore a bright orange collar that was all but obscured by his long fur. A chill wind swept across the shallow, murky waters of Utah Lake. Murphy followed a trail toward the lake, but before reaching the water, he peeled away and walked toward the decaying remains of a home. It was tucked into a thick wall of trees and bushes growing along the lakeside. Paulette could see it was little more than a concrete foundation with some sagging beams, full of shadow, and who knew what else.
Yeah, that was really creepy, and the dogs were interested in it. I'm sure people have been down there in it. The dogs were showing interest in it.
Murphy continued on to the lakeshore. The ground was littered with garbage. Broken office chairs, discarded fishing tackle, empty bottles of Mexican beer, chunks of concrete, the decaying remains of a dead animal. But Murphy didn't seem to care much about any of that. At the water's edge, he started to alert. He'd caught the scent he was looking for. Cadaver.
My dog walked into the water. The breeze was coming toward us, pawed the water. That's what he would do when he couldn't reach a source. He would paw at it. So I know he picked up something.
Murphy didn't like to swim. So his decision to wade out into the lake, up to his shaggy belly, was unusual.
It's really tricky. So even when you get some kind of a positive result from your dog, you still have to analyze the situation unless they've got their nose right on what you're looking for.
Murphy was hitting on what Paulette called a high air scent. The wind out of the northwest seemed to carry it, maybe from the far side of the lake. Meanwhile, another dog named Lacey showed particular interest in a couch someone had dumped nearby. Paulette wondered if perhaps a fisherman had cut himself on that couch, or maybe the scent came from the body of Susan Powell. A man named Tim Oliver had reached out to Paulette's organization, American Search Dogs, in March of 2010. He explained he was working with a group of psychics in the hopes of finding Susan. They'd received an impression telling them to search the northwestern shoreline of Utah Lake around the community of Saratoga Springs. The members of American Search Dogs were all volunteers, but they'd each spent significant time and effort training their dogs. They were well-known and well-respected. They were also no strangers to getting tips from psychics.
For me, on the psychics, I'm like, I don't know. You know, I don't know if there's something to it or not, but it was just like every other search. I thought, well, it's a good practice for the dogs. It helps validate for them if they think they've found something. So we'll go ahead and see what we can find.
After that blustery March day on the shoreline, Tim Oliver got in touch with Saratoga Springs police and told them what he had seen. Detective Bruce Champagne visited the site a few days later. He looked around, checking for any sign of blood or a body. He found only garbage and a pile of discarded men's clothing. Champagne called Paulette, who described what she'd observed with Murphy. She told the detective her dog had caught the odor of cadaver. Of that, she was certain.
Yeah, I'm sure there was something, but I'm not sure what it was.
West Valley police also caught wind of what was happening. Paulette shared her log from the search with the West Valley detectives, including the exact GPS coordinates. The coordinates were right behind a new subdivision. Two of those new homes had been listed for sale on Josh's real estate website at the time Susan disappeared. What's more, the subdivision sat just south of the route Josh had claimed to have driven on his way back from the Pony Express Trail. Detectives reasoned he might have stashed her, alive or dead, in one of those homes. West Valley sent their own dog team down to search the shoreline, but came up with nothing. They knocked on the doors of the two homes. One was still vacant. A pair of roommates had just barely bought the other. Neither recognized Josh. The police got permission to bring their cadaver dog into both houses, but the dog didn't alert. But afterward, the roommates shared a story with the detectives. They said while house shopping in January, their realtor had shown them another house right next to the one they'd ended up buying. That house had reeked of rotten food or a dead animal or some other awful thing. The smell was so strong, they said, they'd had to leave the house to avoid becoming sick. The property manager for the subdivision told the detectives there'd been several homes in the neighborhood under construction in December. A large dumpster full of building waste had been parked at one of the lots on the day Susan disappeared. Had Josh known that? Might he have left Susan there, hidden under scraps of shingle, lumber, and drywall? They dug into the paperwork and learned a waste disposal company had picked up the dumpster a week later on December 14th. The contents eventually ended up at the Cedar Valley landfill in the small town of Fairfield. West Valley police descended on the landfill with a team of cadaver dogs. They'd identified where the waste from December had been dumped. It covered an area about as wide as a football field and as long as 2.5 football fields placed end to end. The junk pile was about 10 feet deep. Searching that volume of material, layer by decomposing layer, would take forever. But it was just the kind of task where cadaver dogs could prove their worth.
People have like 5 million scent receptors in their nose. Dogs have about 250 million scent receptors. So it isn't even just that they can find this stuff, even buried or whatever, but they remember the scent that they are looking for.
That's incredible.
It is incredible.
American Search Dogs wasn't involved in the Cedar Valley landfill search. West Valley used its own people for that. The dogs went over the huge pile of trash, alerting at one particular location. A track hoe rumbled over to the spot and started to dig. The police and dog handlers, wearing sweaty t-shirts, jeans, and boots, all crowded around. The excavator unearthed a slimy, stinking mass of what might best be described as biological matter. Someone scooped it up with a shovel and put it onto a slab of plywood. Then, using a gloved hand, a detective poked into the mass. It turned out to be excrement and animal remains. Susan's dad, Chuck Cox, went for a drive with the West Valley Police on March 18th of 2010. A captain and lieutenant took him out to the Pony Express Trail, hoping to impress upon him just how difficult a task they faced. They drove the dusty route from east to west, crossing wide basins full of salt and sage. Their roughly 170-mile trip from Faust, Utah to West Wendover, Nevada, took more than 4 hours. They passed by Simpson Springs and Fish Springs, places Josh and Susan had visited. They drove through the Gold Hill ghost town, where detectives had 2 weeks earlier inspected a large number of abandoned mines.
It all made sense. It was logical what they were doing. But the part I don't know about is what other leads, and it's always bothered me, what leads, because we would get calls from people say, I told the police this and they haven't got back to me, and it was a viable lead.
Chuck kept in close contact with the police.
Well, they were very cooperative and accommodating to my wild ideas because, frankly, this happened in the middle of the night, and they really had no clue where to look.
In June of 2010, Chuck saw an online comment on a Salt Lake Tribune story about the case. A person using the screen name Lockkeeper had reported seeing a silver-colored minivan parked by some ponds alongside I-15 south of Salt Lake City on the morning of Susan's disappearance. The two ponds were on the west side of the freeway, in the suburb of Draper. Detectives checked the ponds, but found nothing. A few months later, in August, Chuck again provided police with the location of an urban pond in the city of West Jordan, where he believed Josh might have disposed of Susan. There was no specific reason to think that.
And so if I would get a feeling or somebody, no matter if it's a ridiculous thing, if it was a place that could be searched, they were willing to go to search there.
West Valley assembled a dive team. They went out to the pond. Its water had the appearance of pea soup. The floor of the pond held a thick bed of silt. When stirred up, it made the water even more opaque. The dive team had to stand shoulder to shoulder and walk across each segment of the pond, feeling their way forward. They dredged up some garbage, but no sign of Susan. Chuck was undeterred. He realized a surplus canal, an offshoot of the Jordan River, also flowed right near Susan's work. Josh could have dumped Susan into the water or along the banks on his way out to the Pony Express Trail the night of his camping trip. the canal crossed under Interstate 80, just south of Salt Lake City International Airport. Airport police allowed West Valley detectives into the secured perimeter of the airport with cadaver dogs in late September. They walked the dogs along the banks of the canal, all the way from the interstate to the spillway, where the water entered Great Salt Lake wetlands. The dogs showed interest at three locations, all on the south side of the airport. A month later, in October, police put divers into the canal at each spot. The third location was right at the end of runway 34L, at the very point where the canal curved around the southwestern tip of the airport grounds. The divers didn't find anything suspicious there, but after leaving the water, they learned a large road sign, like the kind you might see suspended over the freeway, was submerged nearby. What if, they wondered, Susan's body had been trapped, submerged, beneath that sign? Could that explain what the cadaver dogs had smelled? They'd have to dive again to find out. But West Valley City Police records don't indicate whether or not they ever did. Paulette Bennett from American Search Dogs kept in touch with many of the people who had been closest to Susan. Friends like Kiersey Helliwell and Debbie Caldwell, as well as with the volunteers and self-described psychics who had devoted themselves to finding her. Those friendships at last allowed Paulette to introduce her big fluffy golden doodle Murphy to an item carrying Susan's scent. It was the pile of yarn Susan had asked her neighbor Giovanna Owings to help her untangle on December 6th, the last day she was seen alive.
It wasn't like a personal thing she'd worn where it was her scent was the strongest, but it was something. Mm-hmm.
Paulette had drawn close to many of Susan's friends. She wasn't alone.
But when you get more of a personal relationship with the families and friends, then you have a tendency to put even more time into these things. And
I think that is Vicky King, another member of American Search Dogs. Vicky and Paulette both went on an outing to the West Desert in mid-October of 2010. They started by driving to Wendover and from there headed south to pick up the Pony Express Trail. They rumbled eastward on the bumpy dirt road past the tiny isolated farming community of Callio toward Fish Springs. One of the people they'd befriended, a woman named Linda Osborne, was along for the ride. Linda had spent a lot of time studying Susan's story. She'd already provided police with several tips. Linda didn't consider herself a psychic exactly, but felt impressions. While on the drive across the desert with the American Search Dogs crew, she suggested places where they might stop and search. In one spot, they found some bones scattered across the ground. They gathered them up to later turn over to police. West Valley records show forensic anthropologists determined those bones were not human. The desert environment was always hard on the dogs. Daytime heat dried out their sensitive noses. The dogs would become so focused on their work, they wouldn't drink enough water. Rattlesnakes, black widow spiders, and tarantulas were a constant threat. Tracking scent on the air also proved difficult. Breezes in the early morning and late evening tended to move scent around, which was good for the dogs. But when the air was hot and still in the middle of the day, scent climbed in a straight line. In spite of this, the dogs showed interest in several possible campsites, places Josh might have been on his December overnighter.
We came across a couple of things that we said to ourselves, he's been here. This is an area he's been in.
One of those spots sat just north of the Pony Express Trail, midway between the Dugway geode beds and Simpson Springs. All three of the dogs alerted there on a soft mound of earth. Then they started to dig.
There was this underground, about 6 inches down, there is this tarp material.
Afraid of what they might find, the dog handlers called off their animals. They recorded the coordinates and reported them to West Valley Police the following day. neither Vicky nor Paulette ever heard a word back from police about their tip.
I don't know if anyone ever went back and checked on her. Dogs all showed a lot of interest right there, and they all noted it. But I don't know if anyone ever really followed up to see if there was anything there.
In fact, they did. West Valley police records show the same officers who had spent much of the prior year searching abandoned mines in the West Desert drove out to that spot on October 19th of 2010. But they didn't find anything. I even took a shovel out to that spot and poked around, but couldn't find any buried plastic. Reflecting on the experience with me, Paulette couldn't shake the sense they'd been looking in the wrong area.
I don't know. I always doubted that she was out there. Maybe if she was, it was for a short period of time. I don't even know if he really went camping there. I don't never heard that there was any proof that he actually even really went there.
But he did. Remember, Detective Ellis Maxwell confirmed that by talking to the sheep herder who'd spotted Josh's minivan on the Pony Express trail on the day of Susan's disappearance. Still, even Ellis doubts Susan ended up somewhere near the trail.
I put a lot of weight that Susan did not go out of the West Desert with him. He did not take her out there. He took her somewhere else. And that's the question, where?
On the next episode of Cold.
She's your wife, for crying out loud. What happened?
I don't know what happened.
If you haven't already, please subscribe to Cold. Toss us a rating or a review. You can find Cold on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Cold Podcast. For video clips, pictures from the case, and more, hit up thecoldpodcast.com. Also, if Susan's story sounds familiar in your own life, in other words, if you or someone you know is experiencing domestic abuse in any form, please get immediate help. In the U.S., support is a phone call away at the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233 or online at www.thehotline.org. A quick thank you to my team, Kristen Sorensen, Eric Openshaw, Ken Fall, Danielle Prager, Adam Mason, Jillian Friedman, and especially Cheryl Worsley for all of their help with this project. The music for Cold was composed by Michael Bonmiller, except for the guitar stuff. That was me. Cold is a KSL podcast. Thank you for listening.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.